Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
That is me.
Brian Brushwood.
It's so good to be here with the two of you on After Things.
We're produced by Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, guys.
Huzzah. There are two L's, but you don't pronounce them. You just say
they're silent. No. They're
should be like a Y. But it's okay. I'm not judging whoever named you.
Good.
Gentlemen, we got an email, and Brian, right before the show, moments before the show, although we go through lengthy discussions and preparation meetings, lots of conferences and things like this, we have entire documents planning what we're going to do. Every now and then we just throw it out the window because we get a question that comes up. We're like, you know what? Let's address this.
Yep.
I know we did a offsite retreat to discuss what we're going to talk about for the show today, but this is more important. Ready?
Yeah.
Bob Walters. Hello. I have a question for After Things. That's us. So I'm a firm believer in the idea of having several irons in the fire, but unfortunately, many of my projects also require some sort of social media presence. Long story short, I'm currently juggling 5 Twitter accounts and 4 Facebook pages, and I fear none are getting all the attention I deserve. I can't afford to hire someone to manage some of them, and I don't want to drop an entire project just because I can't keep up with the social media component. How do you guys handle all your social media accounts? Do you have any tips for maximizing the effectiveness of your posts so you can get the most mileage out of them? Do you have any advice for automating posts, automatically posting when you publish an episode, et cetera? Thanks, guys, and good luck with your own projects. It's a great question because I consider myself a complete failure at this.
Oh, wait, what do you mean? Why label the failure? Keep in mind you have a sizable audience and you go live on Periscope on the regular. You are good about following through and responding to everyone. As far as I know, you don't have 5 other accounts dying on the vine, do you?
I mean, they died a while ago.
Oh, so great. You're a success at culling quickly.
Well, I'm gonna give you an example, and I'm going to give you a historical example. It's kind of interesting. You ever, and it relates to this, I swear. Familiar with the bent pyramid, right? The bent pyramid, right? This pyramid that goes like this, and then it goes like this, right?
I don't think I've heard of this.
Bryce, you pull up an image of the bent pyramid because, like, the Egyptians, building like these sort of like pyramid shaped objects was something that was tried around the world because, like, hey, what's cool? Like big things that we build, we can build big things because So you look at the bent pyramid, right?
Oh, it looks like they were very ambitious in the beginning and then just realized, hey, man, we got to wrap this up or it's going to be an incomplete pyramid forever. So they just sort of...
Yeah, the angle was wrong. Now, if you look at the final angle the bent pyramid ended at is pretty much the angle that other pyramids from henceforth were made at. So they started at a very steep angle. Like this thing was going to be – would have been amazing, but like it kind of collapsed on itself, kind of like fell in. Like, oh, without mortar or interior structures, there's kind of a shape that you can't really beat when it comes to just laying rocks on top of each other. And they looked at that top shape and were like, you know what? Let's just build a pyramid at that angle. Okay. And so basically it sort of affected the design of pyramids, from henceforth on in. And then sort of you let things sort of collapse and then you see the pattern of which they form. For me, I would love to be ambitious. And I tried Hootsuite and these other things for doing social media posts and stuff. Granted, I could use a tool that would post like Weird Things podcasts out there. There's a couple times where I think I should be like, hey, automatically tell people, hey, this is what I'm up to. But I hate posts from people that are automatic posts. When I'm on, I don't hardly go into Facebook, but if I see so-and-so from Twitter posted this and they don't respond to a single thing in their Facebook thing, I'm kind of like, F you. You're just advertising here, And I go into Facebook and I'll say like, hey, I got a new book out, whatever. But I don't, if I'm putting a thought-provoking comment there or something from some other media, then I'm going to stick around and talk about it.
Yeah. Man, I got to tell you, I don't think we I do want to hear about the genesis and death of previous accounts on your end, Andrew. But part of it is fueled by my frustration for the business model of Facebook. But it's been kind of a year and I've just given up on Facebook. I think I've made 3 posts in the last year and I've realized like where I'm white hot is on Twitter. That's what is most complimentary to my natural set of talents, which is speaking freeform and having live discussions and trying to respond politically, you know, asking charged questions and then engaging in hopefully a fun and interesting way. I don't know that there's a lot of value of being, you know, not very interesting on 5 accounts at once versus just be interesting on 1 account.
I heartily agree. Justin, what's your hot take?
I forget where I heard it over the weekend, or maybe it was over the holiday. Somebody said, you know, your fans don't follow you, you follow your fans, right? And it was like something that made me think that when it comes to like this, like why do you have 5 social media accounts? Theoretically, it's because people identify with this one strand of your life, right? Or this one project that you're doing, and they only want that to the point where they want to exclude anything else you talk about, right? So if somebody likes me and they just want to hear my random opinions, but they don't want any ads for the contender, but maybe they do want ads for, or they want to know when a new Stickers or DIAF thing is out, right? Like, I think ultimately, if there is not a desire, a measurable desire from your community to have something separate, then there is no point in having something separate.
I don't do Facebook. I hardly ever, like Brian, I hardly ever do Facebook. And I understand it's a very important part of a lot of people's lives. It is the glue. It's a way they connect and they do that. I understand that. But if that's not a thing you need, if it's not a thing that's useful to you, if it's a time waste, which is what it is for me, you don't want to spend time there. I don't want to go in there. It's very easy for me to go into, and also because, you know, hey, I have this great topic I put on Facebook, and great, there's a big long conversation there. Like, you know, one, you tend to ignore it, not care. Two, it's just, so what? You know, I like to do Twitter, pop something in there, say something, respond to something. I try to respond to every at reply that I get on there. I do my best to do that. And I try every other day or so. I try to be there every day when I can. And it's very easy to control. But we've gone off on our opinion on the problem with Facebook. And the problem with Facebook is why Facebook is so successful, because it's so effective at capturing your attention. It is one of these things where I talk to friends who are like, oh, no, I'm into Facebook. And I'm like, let's talk about your productivity. And then they'll, you know, I kind of do this sort of like, let's do this Facebook detox. You tell me how much you're really using it and tell me how much you're defending it versus how productive you are. And people often have a reckoning. They're like, oh, wow, I didn't realize this. And the problem I have is like every time I work with another organization, a publisher, a TV network, whatever, their social media department's like, we need you to do this on Facebook and this on Facebook, because Facebook has sold them on the idea of how, you know, they need these tools and do these things. And some people are effective at it and they think that that's going to apply to everybody. And I'm like, well, I'm a Twitter guy. Like, oh, well, we think this works over here. I'm like, I'm a Twitter guy. You know, I have people who tell me to get Twitter accounts to follow me, you know, so that's working for me and it's my best thing. And, you know, I do, you know, I would, the problem, like I would do Periscope. I love it. But I would go do Facebook Live because I know the people who I'm working with, my professional partners, they only pay attention to Facebook because that's their own bubble. And they have no idea what I'm doing outside that bubble, which is problematic because, and I would do Facebook stuff just so they think, oh, Andrew is doing stuff. And I'm like, you have no idea what I'm doing in social media, you know. So it's frustrating.
Yeah. Bryce brings up a good point in the chat, which is like, well, the whole point of outreach is to go to where the people who haven't yet figured out that you're their fans yet are. Right. And mm-hmm. I will freely admit that if I was in a perfect world, yes, for each of your 5 separate projects, there should be 5 distinct brand voices and 5 distinct avenues to reach out through social media through each of those. However, that, as we're seeing in this email, butts up against the fact that you are a single human being who doesn't have an infinite amount of time, energy, and effort. And if that is going to be the case, I feel like you're better off playing to your strengths than trying to do everything half-assed.
I'm going to also make an argument here, too, that when it comes to virility, I think that there are certain things that make, you know, longer form stuff. If you, you know, like we're watching Me Too works pretty well on Facebook for longer stories. But so many of the stories that we talk about here are things on Twitter. And it's fun to disparage Twitter, like, oh, Twitter's dead. Twitter's this. Meanwhile, I hear what so-and-so said on Twitter. And it's hilarious because you see this. It's like this. It is the chosen medium of the president of the United States, for better or for worse, and it's a conversation every single day. And you can say, well, if I'm not on Facebook, yeah, but somebody you know is. Somebody you know who follows you is on there. And if it's worth making it, if it's really worth one human telling another human out there, it's going to get out there. You know, I called up Brian Friday night. Oh, my God, look at see what Elon Musk said. You know, I'm telling everybody this stuff because Elon Musk on Twitter, it's easy to follow, very easy to follow through. And I don't get stuck in the friggin' molasses fire of Facebook by going in there. I think one outlet is highly effective. GD, a man became president by tweets.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, oh, you know, if he had more Facebook outreach, like, you know, the $50,000 the Russians spent on ads, please shut up, okay? That it was his own steam, his own momentum that got his – and his the ability to create outrage, whatever you want to do. I'm just saying that
we talked about him because
of the things he said.
By the way, you know, let's go ahead and make President Trump a model – of the efficacy.
I didn't say any names.
No. Okay, that's fine. I will.
Unnamed president.
Regardless of how you feel about the president, let's evaluate how he used Twitter to get him the edge. Like, let's go ahead and attribute his presidency to being on Twitter. What did he do? Things he did not do. Ever use scheduled tweets. Ever use banal quotes that you dug out of
brainyquote.com.
Yes, exactly, right? And, you know, look at me. I'm engaging. I said something. No, he spoke from the gut, from the heart, and from his soul. For good or for ill, he invoked a passionate response in people, positive and negative, and yet ultimately he captured attention. And this goes back to, a friend of mine, Nate Staniforth. His book comes out next month, and I think we talked about this, where I'm doing my best to help him to get a lot of pre-orders, because that is very, very important going into the launch of the book, especially if you want to have any chance of showing up on any kind of list. And, you know, Nate has worked on his craft and his product for the last 2 or 3 years, and yet it was this flash for him where he was like, holy shit, Brian, it seems like one of the most valuable resources you could have is the attention of other people. And I think he's 100% right. And it doesn't matter if it's good attention or bad attention. And I know this cliche to say, and I know it makes our skin crawl when we think of some bad attention that people generate, but authenticity and directness and availability will do more to instigate engagement than just about anything else.
You know, and we live in an environment where we don't trust the media. And I'm going to say rightfully so, any media, whatever, right, left wing, whatever. We don't trust it because everybody has an agenda. We don't trust it. They're inauthentic. They say things to support their own cause. When somebody says something we feel is real, you know, that resonates, you know, and to other, some of us might be like, yeah, that's real. And I don't like that. What they said, that scares me. That's irrelevant to how that affects other people. We've watched, you know, in politics, we've watched campaign after campaign, like, oh, so-and-so's killing on social media. It's like there are five people writing his tweets, you know, for other people, you know, for campaigns. It's like, I don't know who the person is. I have no idea. I know there's a team putting this there, and the team to get them elected isn't the same team that runs things, and everything feels inauthentic. And then we're watching in this whole, you know, media breakdown of personalities and stuff, of people who've professed values that they don't have. You know, and just everything feels inauthentic. So somebody who speaks seems real. I think authenticity is like, yeah, authenticity. Like I've had I've tried to tell people I work with my publishers, like, the most effective tool I've had has been Periscope, you know, and I get people all the time on Periscope, like, oh my God, you're real. You're real. Like, you're just a guy and a cat talking to us. I'm like, yeah, I'm not like, you know, I'm not putting these inspirational quotes and crap like this. And, you know, that stupid self-media posturing that people do that just makes my skin crawl because it gets to be so fake and that killing it mentality. You know, I just, you know, I just want to be a real person because, you know what? I don't know. I've got my quirks, but I like people. I'm likable enough in small doses.
Ultimately, sure, it seems in its own way counterintuitive to double down on what you're doing and double down on what's working and then feed everything else from that. But while you want outreach to be the capturing of new eyeballs, the best way to capture new eyeballs is by like having the closer you are to qualified audience, and you are closer to a larger qualified audience if other people who already like you are retweeting you or replying to you. Like, that's social proof. That proves authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. If you see people going back and forth. And I think that's what both of you guys have done with Spectacular Effect.
But and it's getting the people who follow me or to tell their friends, oh, check this book out. Read this book by this guy. You'll like it. It's not like, oh, I read this most amazing Medium post by this author. Now I'm going to read his book. It's no. Somebody who read the thing, you know, and maybe had, you know, a choice to read a bunch of things and then said, oh, I engaged with him. He was kind of interesting, or I saw this thing. I read it. Now I'm going to tell other people to go do this thing. You know, I think that's word of mouth is still the most important form of currency there is. And you would get higher degrees of, you know, the more authentic you are with the people you're talking or the more engaged they are, the better that gets.
So do you guys have advice specific for Bob? Because Bob's issue is that he's got too many pages, and let's say consolidation and merging some of these is not the first option here, right? Like,
you know, he's got five projects, right? So is he juggling five for five separate projects? And I think that, yeah, the problem is he knows what the problem is. He's trying to do too many things. I deal with this. You know, I couldn't sleep last night. I woke up late because I've had this wonderful situation where I've had people say yes to things I never thought they would say yes to. And now I'm committed, you know, overcommitted, you know, beyond belief right now. And it's good. And I'll figure out how to make it work. But I focused on one thing. You know, I focused on two things. Like my life became 6 years ago. There were two driving forces. You know, I was paying the bills, doing like regular routine, put out magic products, working with Justin and iTricks. That was just sort of clock in, clock out on that. Then it was take meetings to go pitch TV shows, and then it was books. You know, I had three things that were taking up my time, but one was I wasn't trying to grow the magic business. That was it. The TV thing was, you know, every few weeks I might go do something on that. The rest of it was writing, writing, writing. Writing was the primary focus. TV dictated my schedule. Writing dictated my time.
So,
and I doubled down on that.
I guess that's the larger question, and I'd be curious because I feel like you and I, Andrew, have already kind of been through the ringer. We've seen projects get launched. You know, you've got the initial excitement phase, and then based on how far it goes, it sort of enters this sleepy harvest phase where however far it got is how far it's going to go until you start injecting a lot of energy in it, and it becomes kind of like, well, this is a decent moneymaker for what it is. We'll just let it kind of run its course. And it sounds to me like it might be that kind of situation here where an expectation of keeping the brand alive is keeping up the regular maintenance by doing some kind of regular posts on social media or whatever. But I'd be curious to hear Justin's take on this. Do you feel like, Justin, that the answer is, well, just inject a lot of electricity in there, a lot of energy, and then it'll blow back up? Or do you feel like when something's not a grand slam home run, when something's not going supernova, but it's generating some level of interest income or whatever, how much energy do you devote to it? And is there a moment that you declare, I'm better off cutting this off and stopping it?
Well, I think that if you're like, oh, okay, well, I've set up five different accounts and I'm having a hard time making them worth it. I'm going to assume, based on his email, that the reason why he assumes, or that he's saying that things could be better, is because he's not getting the engagement that he would want. And I think that that's life telling him he's doing too much. Like, that's, yeah. if you can't fit all the stuff that you're doing into the place where you are talking to the most people, then think about your resource allocation. You know, the only extra Twitter accounts that I have and Facebook accounts are for the Contender, because as much as I can always plug the Contender on my podcast stuff, that is, it's hard to serve two masters if I'm selling stickers and I'm also selling the game, right? Like, that's I think just a lot. It's a lot to focus on, and kind of makes things a little bit challenging. But even then, I've just made a decision on the Contender account that, look, when we got stuff, we'll tweet it, right? You know, if I ever wanted to take that brand and make it something more than just the card game, right, or you know, the card games, then I would think about doing more with it. But for right now, it's literally just to let everybody who likes that game know new stuff is here. And we'll tweet it a couple times, and that'll be it.
And that's a very, I mean, that's a point where, you know, when you have something has its own momentum, then you spin it off into its own thing. And you know, that has a life of its own, and it's worth being its own thing. We did that, you know, iTrix was our Magic news site and still is. And that's a thing that was separate from my brand because I wanted this thing to function without me. And it started off, you know, just in working on this thing. And, you know, that was going to be separate. It was never going to be Andrew Main Incorporated with iTrix. It was just, hey, here's a project. I'm working on this with Justin. It's a separate thing, and it lives and dies by that. I think that, you know, when you're trying to manage five things, I have a friend that used to say this, which it's imprecise, but it still is helpful. And he says, like, you know, if you have a 150 IQ and you're trying to do two things at once, you get 75 IQ points on each thing, you know, which, you know, it's like, well, we know it's not literally true, but it is in a way. It feels that way. And if you're trying to come up with the best ideas you can for something, there's a time when you say, I have some projects that I pick up because I've done everything I can on this other thing. And if I keep putting more time on it, I'm just going to drive myself nuts and everybody else around me. I need to go do something else. It's why I picked up coding, because I'm like, I can just sit in front of my computer and code for hours and take my mind out. You know, that's my break from other stuff. But, you know, if you're nothing's getting traction, focus on one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Like, if stuff looks like it's stalled out, then, you know, focus on where you have momentum. Focus on where you have a voice.
Yeah, and I mean, it can be, you know, it's in the Scott Adams. I loved what he said in his book was, I forget the name of the, you know, like How to Fail at Everything or whatever, but.
How to Fail at Everything and Still Win Big.
Well, yeah, specifically talking about energy versus passion.
Yes, and what's interesting is he also talks about the inverse of what you were just saying is like focusing on two different things, you divert half, you know, your attention at any given time, whereas he talks about like being able to do two things. It's better to do two things good than one thing excellent, right? Which is the inverse, because being able to do two things good or being good at two things at the same time doesn't require any more energy. Like for me to fix a toilet while also speaking Spanish is different from me from running a Spanish blog and then separately running a plumbing blog. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And we saw that Brian and I saw this in Magic where we're like, you know, There's a method called the double lift. We don't need to get into it. Like, man, you can learn 50. You can spend a lifetime perfecting that.
Yep.
Do you know how many more shows you're going to get once you move beyond, you know, a week's worth of good effort on that? Yeah, zero. But for many magicians, it becomes the thing they want to focus on because business stresses them out. Everything else stresses them out, but they can work on a move. I can just go on a move and I don't have to deal with everything else. It's like playing a video game. Nothing wrong with it. And you could justify it however you want. It ain't going to help in the grand scheme of things. And I get into discussion with people like, you know, like, oh, I'm working on this. I'm like, what is if your goal is to perfect the technique, then that's wonderful. I think that's a beautiful thing. But when their conversations are always about getting more shows and audiences, it's like, you know, I could go to a lighting convention and study spotlights and figure out the perfect light, the perfect natural tone and microphones and things like this, and ain't going to make my show any better, you know, than an appreciable. It's a law of diminishing returns.
Yes, and diminishing returns is a good way to put it, because what'll happen is you'll get higher and higher in this strange tournament where there's fewer and fewer competitors, and now the rewards become not that you get booked, you go from nothing to a weekly close-up gig at a steakhouse, or the next phase from the steakhouse to, you know, doing a corporate show or whatever. But now it's like at the very high end of that tournament, you'll look at seven magic forums, and in two of them, you'll find one post in which somebody says your double lift is better than this other guy's double lift, and you'll fist pump alone in your office to no additional dollar signs.
Yeah, or, you know, get like, well, you know, if you win the rolled such and such magic competition today, I got work. Like, yeah, that's a dumb game to play if you're trying to get work. The amount of effort and hours, the amount of hours wasted by magicians trying to win those competitions for the goal of getting work. Like, I say this about America's Got Talent shows like that. Like, I want to go do America. I'm like, listen, if you count all of the magicians that have tried and all of the time they spent on it, it's a waste of time. Statistically speaking, it's a complete waste of time. If you say, you know, hey, I want to spend the next 6 months, I'm willing to put whatever I can, and knowing that, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have to probably shell out 10, 20 grand if I'm a magician to really, you know, get my stuff up. If you want to spend the money and spend the time doing it, better strategies. They're better strategies. So anyhow, you know, it comes back to what we talk about. Focus. It's focus. And if you can't do five things well, that's, you know, like you said, that's the Brent pyramid. It's not working. Now, you can take something, pick one thing, succeed, bring on a partner or somebody to run that for you. You know, Elon Musk does, he's got a space company, he's got a rocket company, he's got a tunnel company, he's got a Hyperloop company, he's got these companies. Why? Because he's got the money to hire the best brains there are. A big part of his time is spent finding people to work for him. You know, I've met people who've been his recruiters. I met the guy that was one of the early recruiters for Tesla. I met another guy. Like, he's got some of the most amazing people in the world finding the best brains, because he knows he can have a crazy idea, go talk to four or five people. They go, yeah, I think it'll make it work. Great. It's a thing now. It's a company. And boom, it's done. Well, I don't have that, you know. So I got to limit myself to, I'm going to write a book. You know, I'm going to pitch a TV show.
Yeah. I mean, they're hardest thing you're ever going to do ever, I think, if you're a self-starter, is shutting things down or distancing yourself or understanding that they need to take a different part of your brain. You know, it's hard because you wrap up your emotions in it, and it's rough. You know, it's rough with podcasting, you know,
I'll say this much. You know, the one line that stands out to me from Bob is, long story short, I'm currently juggling 5 Twitter accounts and 4 Facebook pages, and I fear none are getting the attention I deserve. I'm going to suggest this. If you would not read and follow these accounts, just don't even bother to invest 1 second into any of them. If you're just churning out the same garbage, new episode out, or you know, version 2.5 coming soon, or retweeting a compliment saying thank you, like, those are fine as part of a larger strategy. But if you essentially have nothing to say that will cause somebody to get upset or to bring joy to their life or to do anything substantive in the day-to-day life of other people that has nothing to do with your product, I think you're better off not even bothering, or at least limiting the amount of barking you do on there.
I do think that new product, like, just super dry, new product added, blank. Like we have an update. Here it is. Like, I think that those kind of things are valuable. Like, because I would rather have that, where I just know that it is this utilitarian thing. I mean, I think that it wouldn't be the craziest thing in the world if you have enough people that are dedicated to the Scam Stuff brand to just have a new product alert thing that is effectively just a drop of whenever there's a new thing, here you go. There's a new thing. It doesn't always have to be out of your voice. There will always be an audience for you talking about it in your voice. But I do think that if it's mechanical, let it be mechanical. That's fine. But, like, at least give yourself that gift of oh, how do I make this something special or grand or whatever? Like, just let that be its own RSS feed that just says, new thing, you're done. At least you save that mental capacity of like, okay, that's out. The people that care about it enough will find it. People that don't won't. And I can now focus on my own thing.
And part of it is, you know, sometimes it's hard to know what to do, but in delayed gratification is a challenge. And I'm a person that's never been able to deal well with it. I've always liked projects I can quickly turn around, but I've had a long conversation with a friend who, you know, is an author who does other projects and was working on some other sort of thing. And I've had, well, what about this book thing? What about the, and it's reflections of the conversations I've had with Justin, but I'm playing a different role, you know, and I've seen where people are like, well, I got this, I'm trying to do this because of this. And I'm like, well, remember when I did this thing? Cause I thought that was my thing. What saved my ass later on? It was the writing. It was the writing. It was the thing I focused on. That was the one I had the most immediate reaction to as I hit the microphone every time I make my point, you know, what was the thing the world said, yes, this is what we want more of. And that's the thing to sometimes focus on, but you sometimes don't know, you don't know what it'll be. But if you put, I'm reaping the benefits right now of efforts I put in 2 years ago. You know, and then, and not just in, and other stuff we'll be able to talk a little bit more about where groundwork I put in several years ago now has come through with, you know, credibility and whatever to be able to do things that if I said, oh, I want to do this 5 years ago, I'd be like, that's crazy. You'll never, nobody will let you do that. Now, you know, things pay off. It's hard. It's hard. It's just working in a vacuum when nobody's paying attention and it's just keeping at it. But
yeah, side note on all that, like if you ever doubt, just believe in the snowball. Snowball's a real effect. It really does get easier farther down the hill, but at some point you have to start. You have to start, and you'll feel silly. Who are you at the top of the mountain rolling this little, you know, grapefruit-sized thing forward? Just trust that eventually it gets really interesting.
Yeah. And if you have the energy for it and you keep doing it, you know, it works. It's easy to do a lot of things. It's easy, you know, anybody can pick up coding. Anybody can open up a social media account. Anybody can do that. But to keep at it and to make it work, it's the same as it's always been. It takes work. You know, when the electronic, you know, word processor came out, you know, was like, now everybody's going to become a novelist. Didn't happen. It didn't happen. You know, it made it easier for a lot of people. But if you had the stamina to sit way through 80 or 90,000 words, you probably could have figured out how to buy a typewriter. You know, the hard part wasn't having a thing in front of you. It lowered the cost of it. But at the end of the day, the determination, when the digital video, everybody's going to become a filmmaker. Do we have a greater, are there, you know, is the talent ratio better? I don't know. Like, I think a lot of film schools are filmed with a lot of untalented people who just, some film schools great, whatever, and it's a mixed ratio of, but people like, I have this equipment, so I'm a filmmaker. Like,
yeah, it doesn't matter how many gizmos come out. There's only so there is a measurable amount of talent in the talent pool, and there's a measurable amount of attention in the consumer pool. And yeah, and it's like, and the stuff in between is just a matter of fidelity.
And I would make the argument what it does do is it does help people at the lower end of the economic spectrum. Is that if somebody who there is like, yeah, mom and dad aren't going to fund me $200,000 to make my film, but I can make it for this. And we've seen cases like this where people who wouldn't have necessarily had the same opportunities as people who came from sort of like, I think it's increased the talent pool.
Yep.
By letting other people have access to it at the expense of people that were able to get into it just because their parents or somebody already had resources.
Agreed.
So it takes work. It takes work.
I got a pick.
Pick.
I already mentioned it, and full disclosure, you're going to hear me mention it a lot over the next month and a half. That is your friend of mine, Nate Staniforth's book, Here Is Real Magic. It's available for pre-order right now.
Beautiful cover. Beautiful cover.
Oh, it's great. It's great. And the whole book just is, in one way, it's The Hobbit. It's there and back. You know, it's like you get in a place, you get disaffected with it, you go out into the big wide world, and you come back and see it differently. But it's true, and it's a real story, and it matters to me that I was there as a friend when I watched him announce, hey, I'm going to India. I'm going to go try this thing. It's going to be insane. Bye. And then he came back and so on. And we recorded a half-hour interview with him that hopefully will be going out this Thursday or Friday of this week on the Scam School channel. So that's youtube.com/scamschool. But Nate has an ability to strip away all of the BS of so many different things and present just the essence of wonder in and of itself, and just to remove all of the nonsense in between is just, I don't know, it's wonderful. And I'm a big fan of the book. We're looking at the trailer right now. If you search Nate Staniforth, you'll be able to see it, or we're going to have it at the beginning of this interview coming up later this week as well.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah, Dave, he's always been very passionate, very, very, always had a deeper sort of look at this, which yeah, I've always sort of felt like, man, should have chosen a bigger arc than magic.
Well, but I think that's one of the things that I adore about Nate is that, and he talks about this in his book, he's always going to be that 7-year-old kid who saw the Milky Way for the first time. And magic is the vehicle by which he wants to bring that experience to everybody at all of his shows. And Here's Real Magic reminds me a lot of that letter that Teller wrote to me 20 years ago where...
Please stop writing to me.
Yes, give or take. It's yes, the MacGuffin is magic, but it's really about what it means to love what you do and then to love it so much and work so closely with it that you become briefly disillusioned with it. And it's about one artisan's quest to recapture that magic and wonder.
Sweet.
I don't really have another pick. I don't know if I have another pick.
Catacombs and Kobolds.
I double down. Nate's a cool guy. Go buy his book.
I may have mentioned this, and I don't know how much of it holds up. I don't know how much of this holds up, but when I read it, it had a big impact on me. That was Maxwell Maltz's book, Psycho-Cybernetics.
Oh, wow. That's an old one, huh?
But it kept getting brought back. It was a big pop psychology book, probably one of the ones that sort of launched the pop psychology movement. But Maxwell Maltz originally was trained like as a plastic surgeon and found that doing small little things on some people dramatically improved their self-image. Sometimes doing drastic things on other people didn't do enough, you know, that didn't change how they perceive themselves. But the idea of developing the idea of the sense of self and how to be more productive, how to be more at peace with yourself, I would say if there was one book that impacted me that helped me get over my, you know, a lot of my insecurities, et cetera, it was that book. Again, not read it in years, but it's one of these things people like. I'm like, you know what? This was the book that, you know, sort of changed my perception on stuff. So the book went on to become a huge hit, launched an entire sort of franchise and empire. And they had a bunch of spurless sort of books like Psycho-Cybernetics and the Stock Market and other kinds of stuff. But yeah, when Maxwell Maltz passed away, he left behind a mass fortune, and it actually ended up founding at Nova Southeastern University, not too far from where Justin and I had lived. Mm-hmm. Big building there, the Maxwell Maltz building. So,
oh wow,
you know. But anyhow, that's the thing. If you ever want to get into like, hey, I don't know, my self-image kind of thing, like take a look at it, because he was a guy who learned, one of the pioneers in like, what does plastic surgery have to do with it? It's like, it gets into the idea of how we see ourselves, how we think the world, if our physical perception of ourselves is sort of starts from. But, you know, so much of how we think about people is irrelevant to that. But it gets in, it's deeper than that, and I'm not doing it justice. But anyhow.
Right on.
Pick. Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.